you do first-person inquiry in community, right? So there were several really good examples of that last year. Russ's was an obvious example. And during Susan's presentation, there was sort of a jam session got going about the nature of sense memory. Mm-hmm. And people were jumping all over the place and jumping in, and it was really a communitarian exploration of the topic of sense memory, spontaneous. And so my feeling is that there's still that tendency to fall into the pattern of, you know, this is my topic and I'm in this conference and I hope the topic fits, but regardless, it's my topic. And, you know, I'll take your questions and then we'll move on. And that's still going to be our tendency. So anything we can do to pull back the other way, I know we have some discussion sessions, but anything we can do that involves not just presenting one person's ideas, but multiple people chiming in and exploring that one person's ideas. Not just through questions and sort of grilling them, but by really, really exploring our own first-person experience as a reference. So if we could work that into it somehow, that would be, I think, better than just saying, well, some people don't present their topics well, and maybe somebody else can do better, you know, which is...
Well, we've got to have a small group. So obviously, you know, we can talk to each other just, you know, naturally anyway. Why don't we leave most of these sessions just entirely open? I mean, rather than trying to prevent a fake formalism in some way. I mean, then we can end up doing part of what we would have done through that and all the other things which we don't yet know we want to do. I don't think we'll have any trouble in having an interesting time talking to each other, do you?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's better not to be too proactive in general.
You wanted to say something,
didn't you? Yeah, I just wanted to say I completely agree with that. And I don't think, I mean, I do have some experience with this work in small groups and this group dynamics, and normally planning the group dynamics is not such a wise thing, because if the topic, if we find something alive, then let's follow it. If we don't, I mean, I've also been to many groups that try to do some nice game, and it's like, you know, a little bit empty.
It can get pretty deadly.
For example, I'm pretty much surprised that, for example, on Saturday there's no group session, or I missed again something, I don't know. But I think we should talk in this group. This is a big group but still manageable, I guess. And I would vote for as much. I'm just thinking because I'm not too well prepared, because I was just in some other world before I came to offering my hour for group discussion, because I'm really interested in possibility of community of first person researcher, of making a community. So if I just talk and present this without feedback, it's no fun. So somehow I would really vote for as much of this setting as we have it here.
Jeff, can I ask a question? Because I mean, I'm confused by the way the whole special is unfolded, just in the sense that when we left last year, I thought we had discussed a lot of going more toward a dialogue and group discussion and so forth. And then something happened when the program got set this year that it became more this program around individual presentations. And then there was something about the individual presentations being too short, I think, and then the individual presentations got extended to an hour. So now it seems like we're in a format where individual presentations, which I say, have become more prominent in the schedule than group discussion. And I guess my question is, if we move back toward this request for group discussion, would that be offensive to people who are now expected to have a full hour for presentations? And if so, how many of those, you know, would be essential to have? And was I think we're reopening up a dialogue here that's gone back and forth since last year in the present, and there may be expectations now from some people who have prepared individual presentations, and it might be, what should I say, abusive for somebody if that's really what their hopes and plans are.
Can I sort of just respond to that? I mean, my idea of my presentation was to have a group discussion. was just to present some ideas, and then I'm not really interested in telling people about my stuff. I want to hear their ideas on what the thing that I want that I'm interested in. And I want some time to just set it up so that I can then pull in other people's ideas.
Well, I'm wondering whether that may be...
That's my interpretation.
That's sort of why I'm sort of trying to nudge this along, because I've heard that now. You're saying that. You brought that up. Nick brought that up as one of his possible presentations. I know that mine is also similarly of that ilk. It's only half a presentation, but it's more a way of getting a certain kind of discussion in motion. So it may be that this is a mute point and we only have, you know, a few people who have very formal presentations that they would like to make, and then there's no issue.
I think we can have a mixture, can't we? Yeah. Whoever wants to opt for a formal. I've got stuff I can present my ideas being a bit like Steve's. I'll present some of my ideas and then hopefully get some discussion about them. But I'm very happy also to go with discussing my ideas with somebody and then getting them to present it and then having a dialogue which will open up to the whole group. I'm game for writing.
And although I said both things I wanted, and I would actually like the chance to present something which uses a lot of images from art and from other media and so on, in order to demonstrate a way of approaching consciousness. And that requires a slightly formal presentation because things have to come in a certain order with particular images on the screen.
I think the point you make is very good. There is always this tendency to fall back in, somebody else said this too, to fall back into a rather standard way of doing it. Since a lot of people seem to be saying that they want to encourage more discussion and allow for more possibilities, maybe the way to do that would just be, to allot the time, to give everybody their hour, and then say, do with it what you will. And then there will also be some extra time, because we've allowed some time for discussions.
In fact, for the extra time, why don't we just leave that open?
And then we should leave that open. I think that's fine. Yeah.
At the end of the day, we, by 4:20 on tomorrow, we will have heard enough have stuff to talk about. And that's just different. And the same with every other day. None of this.
It sounds fine to me. Now, the one thing is, if people want to experiment with this idea of having someone else do their presentation, that'll require a little advanced planning. Mm-hmm. So I think if people want to do that, I mean, they have to find someone to present it to, and the two of them have to get together and then use that time somehow. So we probably ought to clarify if anybody, who wants to try that. But other than that, I think we could just, it sounds like we could.
My hunch about that is that it sounds like it could be a brilliant way of organizing a conference, and maybe not this one, the idea sounds to me very promising.
Susan's idea was that we would do that in this general discussion period tomorrow, instead of having the general discussion.
Mm.
I think, wouldn't it?
The trouble is that doesn't quite mesh with people doing the presentation themselves, unless they want to give up that slot or do something else for their presentation. I mean, maybe, Nick, you could do one of your things with someone, as they could summarize
your ideas for one of your things and then do your presentation on your other.
I'm actually happy to drop this idea. I actually think we should just, as Adam was saying, let's loosen up and not try and control how we do this and just have some open discussion at the end of every day. Wouldn't that be best?
Susan, how do you,
I'm happy. I don't mind.
Perhaps it would be useful for me to say, when I made this suggestion, whenever it was, which I think was by email shortly after this thing.
Yes.
I never expected it to be taken seriously, actually. The object was to throw a curveball and see what happened as a way of trying to alter the PowerPoint presentation.
I think I may want to organize a conference on that basis sometime.
Well, it might be a great idea. Yeah. I don't know. I've never done it. I've never seen it. I'm not swearing by it in his life, but trying to change it.
One small problem, and it's a big problem. So this, we don't all know each other terribly well. I don't know anyone well here. So I don't know kind of who I want to be my partner in this enterprise. And,
from my point of view, that's the best deal, because if you had to explain it to me, I don't know hardly anything at all about your stuff, which is probably where this idea came from, because I'm a psychologist in the middle of philosophers, and you guys are talking about a lot of stuff that you all take for granted and it's not what I spend my days doing most of the time. And so for you to have to explain it, but I'm a pretty bright guy. And so for you to have to make your ideas plain to somebody like me might be a pretty cool thing.
Sounds like a marriage made in heaven.
Do we have time for everybody to take 2 to 5 minutes and say who they are and what's brought them to this particular event?
Sure. You think that would be a good thing to do now? That was part of what we were planning on doing. And we've kind of gotten...
Bear in mind.
Why don't we just tell each other who we think?
Yeah, exactly. Right.
This is where this idea was much better than what we did last year. Because what we did last year was we started by everyone going around the room. The first person took 2 minutes. The second person took 4 minutes. The third person for 8 minutes. We actually
have to
finish.
Yes.
That's
the end of the thing. And the last person is still talking.
That's right. We'll be talking by the end.
Let's introduce each other.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. If we talk to, the person next to them.
So who are you? No, you can't do that. Who is that?
and then the other person isn't going to take longer than the 2 minutes that they spent finding out about the other.
I might suggest another little variation on this kind of basic check-in thing that I've used sometimes, is that instead of going around the room, from left to right or right, whatever, which, can get a little slow because when you're point is coming, that, well, I do a kind of a Russian roulette thing, is that Jack would choose one person to give their presentation, and then that person would choose the next person. So there's an incentive to stay
away. Russian roulette? Couldn't it just be roulette?
It has a quality of keeping you awake, I've noticed.
I have a wristwatch with a 3-minute timer on it.
Okay, that's another thing that will move things along.
And it keeps you done.
Actually, I like the idea of introducing someone else, but I don't think we quite know each other well enough.
Let's have a go. Jack, who are you going to introduce?
No, it starts by, what we do is everyone talks to their neighbour now for 3 or 5 minutes, and then the neighbour introduces the person they've spoken to in some order. So that's how it works. So everyone goes into a pair now, and in parallel finds out about their neighbour, and then the two neighbours introduce each other.
Well, I got Jack in this goddamn stove. Like, which one am I?
That's right. It's a hard choice.
If there is an even number of people, then there's a trio.
We've got 13, unfortunately.
Well, so there's a trio, and then.
Yeah. But with the stove makes 14.
We're stuffed if the stove is the start.
It's a very interesting stove.
Could you not just?
Well, actually, Jane, I'm assuming you're not. You wouldn't be introducing yourself. Is that true, or am I wrong?
Me?
You.
I don't know. I just wanted.
You're going to?
Wow.
I'm not really a part of this group. I was just coming to introduce myself as not a part of this group. However, since I am here, and I'll probably be around and at meals and encouraging.
Okay.
I was just getting too complicated. I would actually like to know.
Yes.
Who people are and what.
Sure, let's just do it.
Let's forgive us. We can just have a thing. At the end of the meeting, we can just
have a thing. Okay,
I'll introduce Nick. Okay?
What?
I'll introduce you.
Can I introduce you?
I don't mind who you introduce. You can then choose somebody. You introduce Claire. Then not very easy to introduce someone else. I think the man or woman who is going to be introduced by me is not very lucky.
I'd like to be introduced by you, particularly since you don't know me.
Okay, so sometimes we have wonderful ideas, but then we kind of come back down to the basics and say, let's just go ahead and do it. I think in this case, let's just go ahead.
We could do Walt's idea and the randomness.
Let's do that.
Okay.
Do you want to start, Walt?
No, you start.
Okay. I'm Jack, and so for me, the issue of community of inquiry is really, really important. I am very enthusiastic about this meeting of this conference because in looking back on last year's meeting, I feel as though, not that I saw it that way at the time, but I would say we were laying some very important groundwork last year. But this year I feel that we really are moving much more towards some specifics. And that's partly because in my own preparation for the conference, I've been looking at what other people have written, and people are starting to really produce things that say, okay, here's how I do inquiry into first or second person consciousness. I think it really gives us something to work with. And so there's three things, I suppose, that are important to me. One is the multiplicity of approaches that are possible and seeing whether we can work in that multiple way, whether it's possible to really have a lot of different approaches, and whether that's consistent with having a community. The second is just the question of community, and can this be a starting place, our group, for having a larger community that can reach out? I mean, I have this feeling that's vague, that we really could be at the point of starting something that can have a much wider influence and a very important influence. And the third I've forgotten. I think that's enough. Mm-hmm. John, why don't you go ahead?
I'm John Bickering. I teach psychology at Park University. I'm interested to be here because I've got various plans about how to introduce first-person issues into what I do, and I'd like to share them with you. I have bought nothing in terms of a prepared. I usually work. I work very much in the way that Walt said. From PowerPoint presentations, which I use as things to remind, I often speak from the audience. So everyone's looking at the screen and I use it as a way of reminding me about what I want to say next. But what I'm going to do here is speak for about 20 minutes. If we get an hour, I'll use 20 minutes and then the rest can take care of itself. I'm very glad to be here, and my purpose in being here is to take away some plans about what to do. And I've got my own plans, but I think they need to be developed, and I'm here to discuss them and develop them. So that's me. Can I ask you? I belong to a group. I'm a very unusual person. You're speaking to one of the only members of a men's group that's lasted for 30 years. And the way we do what we're doing now is we have a corp. And you toss the corp to whoever's going to speak next and try to corporate through it for you.
I'm Wendell Wallach. I was part of a community of inquiry, I would say, for about a decade, largely in the 70s. And this was specifically people who had come out of more spiritual interest. Most of them had engaged in meditation for a long period of time. And we looked at, it had both a Socratic style and, I would say, an embodied, self-aware style coming together. And we really tried to probe questions like, what is thought, what's the nature of consciousness, what's the relationship between thought and thinking and awareness and feelings, and, you know, I'm not going to go into all of that. But it was a very vital thing, and it was very much in the context of languages of self-transformation and self-understanding at the same time as there was a lot of trying to cut through what were delusions or assumptions and put those aside and get more in touch with what we were actually perceiving. That kind of community I found to be remarkably vital, and was, I think it was a kind of first-person science before anybody was using languages like that. But it was also in the context of spirituality and who understood and who didn't understand. And so I think it came crashing down around various sociological and political dynamics that were hard to keep quiet, you know, after a decade or more of people being together. More recently, I've gotten much more caught up in the more academic approach to these questions. And Jack and I encountered each other in Tucson about, what was it, 4 years ago now, 3 years ago now. And it was largely, I think, something we both felt in terms of the first-person perspective getting lost as anything other than a very academic kind of discussion there, and the fact that both of us had that kind of first-person relationship to the subject that became the precipitating event, I think, that led to this gathering. And I think the main thing was just my encouraging Jack to go and you know, and take on the sponsorship of this. And I think Steve was there also and echoed that feeling. So I think I'm just sort of interested in, what should I say, in where those two perspectives meet, where people who have approach this from a more philosophical and intellectual and academic perspective, whether they can come together with people who have tried to bring some degree of, I hate to use the word objectivity, to this subjective experience and try to develop some discipline in that and see whether there's really a dialogue between those two orientations. So I'll toss the card to Claire.
I began to try to study subjective experience 15 years ago when I began a thesis with Francisco Varela, and since then I'm trying to test, to apply and improve first and second person methods, and I'm also a meditator, Buddhist meditator, and I try to make links between these two approaches. And in fact, I since these years I had a lot of surprises, and I would like to share them with you and to discuss them with you. That's why I'm there.
That's okay. You have to choose the next person.
Oh, yes.
For long years, I'm interested in teach Kant and Kant's epistemology and metaphysics. And one of Kant's concerns is the establishment of preconditions for conscious experience. And that's taken me towards machine consciousness in all sorts of ways, but it's also taken me gradually past notions of creative imagination and the application of concepts, whatever, productive imagination, to the importance of the body and agency and a phenomenal and pre-reflective activity, which is a pre-requirement for any kind of conscious experience at a higher level. And so I have found myself moving towards people like Merleau-Ponty and Heidegger, of course, and Walter Benjamin, thanks to John, and people like Whitehead, of course, Whitehead's later work. And to my great delight last year, Steve asked if I would come to the first of these meetings. And I had an absolutely super time where some of the work which I thought was I was doing out on a limb, I discovered Maxine had been doing since 1966. This is Maxine Sheets Johnson, who's super happy. And Sean had been working with for years, and we had, as James has recalled, a really very absorbing and interesting evening around some of the stuff I was developing, which I'm going to give a little bit more of. But it was super because Wendell gave me a lovely phrase which I've used ever since, talking about the felt dynamics of the body. And actually in conversations with Nick by email recently, I've come back to something which I had not been aware was influencing me, and it was my interest in the metaphysical poets, but also the poetry of Hopkins, and how much of the body plays a part in their poetry. So I think the poets have an awful lot to tell us about conscious felt dynamics and how it's a requirement for a conscious engagement. So I'll have to root about and find some nice poetry to tell you about. So, oh, now I've got to pick something. Matej.
My name is Matej. I am a psychologist. I specialize in social psychology. And in my approach social psychology mostly theoretically, and I think that the central problem of social psychology is the question of the relationship between the individual and society. So, what is the nature of this relationship? And I, after I studied the works of George Herbert Mead and Bergman, Lukman, and so on. And so,
could you repeat those names?
George Herbert Mead.
Oh, yes.
Dietrich Bergman and Thomas Lukman, authors like that. Well, after I kind of made, let's say, after I kind of made myself a map of how this individual and society are related, I really discovered that what I was doing really was that I was trying to solve my own question of the relationship between myself and society. And so then I came to the question of intersubjectivity, and from there to first person inquiry into intersubjectivity. And that is my point of origin into this. And then now I'm working with, I'm leading a group that is about self-knowing, as I call it. I really recognize a lot of what Wendell was talking into this group. And last year, Urban, me and Jack started some project on an internet site devoted to an establishment of a different kind of science or approach to research. So now I get right.
Thanks. In a previous lifetime, I was an aeronautical engineer. And then I decided I didn't really want to be an aeronautical engineer for the rest of my life and thought I wanted to be a trumpet player. And so I joined the Army band because that was Vietnam time and you had your choice in the United States at that time, either to stay working where I was working, which was actually designing rockets for nuclear weapons, so I was safe in that regard. But I joined the Army band, and my job in the Army band eventually became for 2 years, from 1970 to 1972, to play taps in Arlington Cemetery. And for people who came back from Vietnam the wrong way. And the way that job actually worked was I would sit in my car until the very end of a funeral somewhere, and then I would get out of my car, walk out underneath a tree, play taps, get back in my car. And I would do that maybe two or three times a day, but I spent a lot of time sitting in my car waiting for the next opportunity to play tap.
Can you explain what taps are?
Oh, no.
I think we can put it in.
Last notes.
Okay, very nice.
Thank you.
So I haven't been trained as an engineer. I would go to the library and get some books that I haven't got a chance to read. But we bought as an engineer, so I read English and history and novels and psychology and whatever, and eventually found that I had read literally all of the books in the psychology collection of the Arlington County Library, which is a pretty extensive collection, and I'd read them all. And I found my experience of reading that this was going to be a very interesting thing. These guys, whoever was writing the books, said, I'm going to tell you the way people really are. And I thought that was cool. So I would read, and when I got to the end of the book, I would discover, well, they didn't really tell me the way people really were. They told me some theory about it, and that wasn't very interesting. So I thought maybe that was my fault. Then I'd read the next book, and the guy would start the same thing. It would be a social psychologist who tells us, this is the way somebody really is. People really are. And I thought that was interesting, but I got to the end. I didn't really find out the way people really were. And I had that experience over and over and over and over again until I had exhausted the entire library, and nobody in any of the disciplines had satisfied me about the way people actually were, except that I had run across one book called One Boy's Day. And this was a book that's not at all well known in the psychology literature, but the deal was that a team of people followed a kid around through his neighborhood for an entire day and recorded what he did. And when you got to the end of that, well, you knew what this kid had done for a day. And I thought, well, that was pretty cool, except that they had spent an enormous amount of effort and clearly interfered with this person's environment. So there were obviously problems with that. But that was, at least you knew something about somebody when you got to the end of the book, and now that was okay. So anyway, I decided that I wanted to be a psychologist, so I went to a graduate school in psychology. And on the way to my graduate training, I decided, well, what I really need to do is to build a beeper, which didn't exist at that time, and to randomly sample thoughts, because thoughts seem to be what made people different from most anything else. And so I should build a beeper and sample thoughts. And so I showed up at my graduate school training, and I said to my the director of clinical training, I was a clinical psychology student, and the guy said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to sample thoughts. And he said, well, that's a great idea, but I don't think you can do it. And I said, no, I figured out on the way here how to build a beeper. And he said, well, that's cool. If you can do that, you should do it. So, and that was 1973, and I did build a beeper, and I have been started out sampling thoughts, which was a quantitative effort. This was a time when behaviorism was more powerful than it is now. But after having sampled thoughts and quantifying them for 5 or 6 years, I was now criticizing myself for the same thing that I had criticized all those other people about, because I had said what I had to say, but I still didn't think it was very interesting about the way people really were. And so I thought, well, what I should do is use this beeper and just try to describe what people's moments of experience were like. And I have spent the rest of my professional life, I guess, since 1979 doing that. And basically, I ask, I'm interested in only one question, what it's like in your experience at some particular moment. And I guess I don't have anything to say. Nowadays, I have hardly anything to say except that. I'm interested in that question and what you have to do it and how you, whether that's a reasonable question. And I'm very interested in your take on that, those of you who are coming to it for the first time. And as far as the community deal, I have been totally a lone ranger throughout my entire career. It's a strange deal for me to think about what a community of inquiry would do, whether that would be good for me, bad for me, good for you, bad for you. I have no idea, but I'm open to the possibility.
I was just thinking that if we had had this community of inquiry, we might have encouraged you to patent the beeper.
I did patent the beeper, and I haven't made it done.
Oh, darn. So much for
that. That's a question. This is now a very well-established technique which everybody uses without quoting you, don't they?
That's correct. That's largely because I abandoned it early on. I was the first person to use a beeper, and like, but by the time the idea had caught on, I had moved on to the descriptive stuff. And nobody except maybe you all think that's very interesting.
But you still use a beeper.
I still use the same, well, similar beeper.
Let's see, professionally I'm an educational technology consultant, and I also am the program coordinator for Yale's program in religion, science, and technology, which is a nascent program, shall we say. And my story is that about 30 years ago, I was involved in a medical experiment that tangentially involved my having certain experiences of consciousness and wanting to, becoming very interested in understanding what those were. And at the time, the dominant framework for doing that was, for understanding consciousness, was behaviorism, which was completely useless for what I was doing. So I basically set out on a pretty solitary quest to see if I could, by in a sense cutting myself off from everything else that was going on, if I could come up with anything original, shall I say. So in doing that, I was influenced by the work of Meher Baba, the Indian spiritual leader, and Michael Polanyi, whose focus was on tacit knowledge. And what I sort of have focused in on over the years is two areas, one of which is the experience of extending oneself into the world via the body and tools and technology, and the other being the nature of experience as a component of consciousness, and also possibly as a domain co-equal to the physical domain, and then obviously needing to examine how those would interrelate. And so my attempt has been to try to develop first-person ways of exploring those issues other than sort of established meditation techniques. John?
No, I've already done.
Oh, you already did. Want to do it again?
Do it more.
Right, Walt?
Okay. I'm actually kind of an outsider here. I haven't really worked within the context of the way this conference is organized. I'm here because I've known Jack, although not well, but for quite a long time, and met Wendell last summer at the Phoenix conference. But I've been increasingly focusing on the question of consciousness in recent years, and I've been a first person for a long time. I guess probably longer than anybody else here. So I have, that's the real only experience I can offer. And most of all, I've really came here and then made an effort to kind of push my schedule around so I could be sure to come here because I want to find out, I guess in sort of the same way that Russ wanted to find out what people are like, I want to find out what people are like that are thinking within this context. I have a feeling that it's a very valuable frame of reference, and not a new one either, as you know, but it's been a bit out of style for a few centuries. And I think that will be very useful. To me, I find that communities of inquiry, sometimes long-lasting, sometimes kind of transient, are both the richest experiences I knew in life. I mean, when people come together with a sense of openness to dialogue and a sense of uncertainty. And that means a lot to me. I don't know what I might want to talk about if I get a chance to here, but there was a subject that came up when I was having a dinner with Steve and Madeline. For me, is the question of, which I think is very relevant to the whole business of first-person exploration of consciousness, which of course presupposes a concept of the self, is how do we define that and what assumptions do we make when we say this is me and this is not me? And I think that there is a huge area of uncertainty that we avoid around that subject, and I would like to not so much tell you about it as define my questions about it and see what you have to say. Steve.
Okay, well, I'm Steve. There are various communities of inquiry that I've been, there's sort of overlap here, intersect here. For example, the consciousness and experiential psychology group that John and I have been involved in for some years, and Susan is now involved in, and I've been sort of at various meetings with Wendell over many years. So, yeah, I know quite a few people from other contexts. And I'm interested in two major things at the moment. Oh, I guess I should say that my background is philosophy, and I've worked in various contexts. I worked in a philosophy department for some years, and then I kind of took a turn in and worked in artificial intelligence for a few years, and that got me interested in the more theoretical issues involved in cognition and computation. And I ended up working in a psychology department, so I'm a sort of resident philosopher in the psychology department. Actually retired now, so I just go in. So the two things that I'm really interested in are firstly consciousness in the context of artificial intelligence, robotics, the possibility of artificial minds, and whether they could, you know, they could actually, there could be anything like consciousness in our sense. The thing that got me interested in that is that when people talk about artificial intelligence, it's very easy to imagine a machine that could perform intelligent operations very much like us, and we could attribute mental properties to that machine. But when people if people start talking about artificial consciousness, that seems to introduce a whole new dimension, and the dimension is the ethical dimension. You know, it doesn't matter a damn if a machine is simply intelligent. It can be as intelligent as you or me, or more intelligent than us. But if all it has is intelligence, then maybe you know we can switch it off or destroy it or kick it around. It doesn't. You know, there is no. It seems that there's no way that we can be cruel to it. But if we imagine it as having consciousness, then immediately all the sort of ethical considerations come in. Perhaps. I mean, I just put that as a question that you may agree or disagree with me. And this really the second thing I'm interested in is just the relationship between consciousness and ethics. And that's really what I want to ask you, the people, about. So I'll say more about that when I give my presentation or discussion or whatever. So that's it. So, I guess, is that for Van? Oh, okay.
No. It's not Van. Nick and Jane.
And Jane. The best come last.
Nick and Jane.
And Jane.
But
I'm with Nick and Jane.
It's like a vintage mind now already.
That's right. Yes.
So, well, obviously the message here is to just explain how I got here. I have my my first education is mathematical physics, but I soon discovered the area of consciousness already before I made my diploma work, and I was doing neural networks a lot and trying to model consciousness in any possible way. So I started doing cognitive science, and being physicist, I somehow became methodologist in cognitive science area. But I was very much disappointed in my after many failures to at least get close to modeling anything like consciousness or even life. And that was the point, I mean, my desperation somehow was just the right, enabled right space. At that time I met some constructivists like von Glasersfeld and these people, and so I started thinking that actually the problem is epistemological, not so much that we just don't know the algorithm or something. So I very much switched into cybernetics, Marella. I was very much into this, and constructivism. So I, as a methodologist or epistemologist, I was researching systems. I was somehow following von Foerster's name, non-trivial systems, which are the systems that where the one who is observing or describing the system is part of the system, and therefore it's like circular mutual influence between the what is observed and the observer. And I try to use constructivist cybernetic ideas in devising the methodology of this, but still very frustrating. And at the end of the line, so from the physics, I somehow traversed all the spectrum to first person. That's where I somehow landed, first person research, which is what I do now. I've done this theoretical and epistemological research of first-person inquiry for many years, but whatever I write or in my book, or, I say it's a, for example, from first steps, it's a participatory position. It's not a theory or epistemology or philosophy. It's a position, and it is the way of me somehow relating to work. It's not just some theory, how I, whatever, that would explain something. It's something in some other level. And that is confusing for me, because obviously if I want to do first-person science, it's not enough that I just have an excellent theory, or that I can somehow describe or even explain phenomena, but I have to be, and I'm so much grateful to Jack's wording, conscious differently. That actually, somehow I came to this conclusion, that's actually the point of first-person research for me, to become conscious differently. Not knowing, at least not propositionally, knowing more, but being somehow, well, that's the best wording I can think of. So that's where I am now, and in my view, what the community of first-person researchers might do is somehow align in this intent, not so much align in results of the research, or not so much align in strict methodologies, but more in the direction we are all facing. That was somehow my one of two topics I wanted to present whenever I get time.
Well, thank you, Owen. I find myself disagreeing with one person after another, so I'll disagree with you first. I don't think that the purpose of the science of consciousness is any form of self-enhancement or becoming conscious differently. I mean, I think that's an interesting exercise, and a lot of Buddhist practices and so on have the intention of changing one's attitude towards oneself and what one lives in, but that's not a science of consciousness. That is using consciousness in an interesting way, which is part of the evidence about what consciousness can do, and which we might want to bring to bear on why consciousness has evolved. But I think a science of consciousness is not to do with what we sometimes confuse it with, which is actually self-development. I'm probably the person who has the most experience of third-person methods of examining consciousness. I began earlier with a research on monkeys, in which inevitably one doesn't have first-person access to. I worked for a long time out in a particular case with a monkey who'd had her visual cortex removed, whom I was initially blind and whom I taught to see. I spent 7 years trying to work out what was going on in that monkey's mind, because it was clear from my interactions with her, I had her as a pet. I took her and walked around the fields around the woods in the laboratory in Cambridge. It was clear that although she could see, there was something different about her first-person experience of seeing, and yet I, as a third person, couldn't have access to that. So I tried to find ways of working out what it might be like to be her, and I came up with the idea that she in fact had a form of what we could subsequently call blind sight, that she was seeing without having any first-person experience of seeing, but she actually had the information that she could access the perceptual knowledge which we associate with seeing, but didn't have any phenomenology associated with it. Later, when my supervisor, Larry Weisskranz, developing his ideas, worked with human patients with visual cortex lesions and discovered blind sight, he actually demonstrated that, in this case, the first-person subject will report just that there isn't anything it's like to be seen in this case. That they can guess, they can guess the colours of things, they can guess positions of things, they can guess the shapes of things, but they can't actually, but they don't feel involved. There's nothing it's like to be the first-person subject of that process. I then went on to work with gorillas in Africa. I worked with Diane Fossey in Rwanda. I spent months sitting with gurus, again, trying to get inside their heads. As a third person sitting in a group like this, trying with these familiar but alien beings, trying to work out what it was like to be done. And then I realized that actually that's what they were doing too. That they were trying to work out not only what it was like to be them, but what it was like to be me. And that most of human social life, and the life of chimpanzees for that matter, was involved in an effort to use third-person methods to get inside the first-person experience of other beings. And so out of that I developed ideas about social intelligence and theory of mind, which have since then been developed in much more sophisticated ways by other people. But all along, my initial introduction to it was, here am I, first person, interested in what it's like to be someone else, to be another monkey, to be a gorilla. In the end, as I developed this, interested in the greatest enterprise which humans beings ever undertake, which is to understand what it's like to be other people, because the whole of our life with other human beings and everything which has been founded on it, human culture and human civilization, is dependent on our ability to get inside the minds of other people. But we do it from the third person point of view. We're trying to access first person experience, but inevitably all we have access to is the expressions, the speech, the context, etc., in which other people are having their first-person experiences. Now, if you think about it, that's all we have about ourselves as well. When it comes to it, all we, in terms of our own first-person experience, we have access to what it's like to be us in terms of what we can say and think and express and understand and bring to the surface about our own first-person experience. And so, in my subsequent work on trying to understand the evolution of consciousness, I've begun to concentrate on what the value is of these public expressions we can give to what it's like to be ourselves, how it changes our behavior, how it matters to us, how it changes our relationships with other people, how our understanding of other people as first persons having similar experiences changes our relationships to them. And the idea I'm coming around to is that natural selection over the course of the last million years or so has profoundly changed the experience of one particular species in the world, and that's human beings, to give them a phenomenology, a remarkable access to self experience, which is probably unknown before in nature, which does not exist in our animals. It doesn't even exist in our primate cousins, but which is one which we think of as primitive, we think of as must be basic to any sentient being, but no, I think it's not. I think our experience of the choir of the sensory world is probably unique to human beings. It's come along late in evolution. It's required some very specific tuning and timing of the phenomena in our brain which underlie sensory experience. And its evolutionary function and its adaptive purpose has been to give us a sense of ourselves unknown before in nature, of beings with spiritual existence, a significance beyond that of any, the pure beings living in a material universe, processing information. Self-esteem, which basically carries us through the crises which human beings have faced as they became more and more cognizant of the problems of being alive and the problems of what it is to live and to die. A life which in the end has no meaning beyond the life of the individual, which became for human beings a crucial existential crisis, I think about 300,000 or 400,000 years ago. My view is that nature has in a sense solved this problem for humans and allowed us to enter a wholly new ecological, spiritual niche by giving us the phenomenology of consciousness. I think that first-person access to this gives us the best evidence we could possibly have for what nature was doing for us, how this could serve us, our understanding of what it's like to be human, our sense of our own importance and the significance it gives us, our consciousness, has been crucial to our biological and social survival. And only first-person methods can reveal the trick, the illusion which was played on us by nature and making us imagine ourselves so much more important than we really are. But only a third-person method can actually expose the nature of this trick. We can only see through third-person methods why it is that we're subject to this illusion, why we should be have come to a view of ourselves which actually is inconsistent both with our material being and the physical nature of the universe of which we inevitably are part. So I think we have to pursue first-person methods now as evidence of why consciousness evolved, how it serves us, and everything which everyone else is certain to talk about, this meeting will be evidence on that plane. Every exercise we undertake, which gives us a sense of the wonders of consciousness, is precisely evidence of what this astonishing miracle which nature has produced in giving us this understanding of what it's like to be ourselves. But nonetheless, it's an illusion. We're not what we think we are. Only a third-person method can possibly expose that trick, because, in a sense, it's been ring-fenced. We're not going to find out by first-person methods the truth about ourselves.
Can I add something briefly? We're not going to be bored over the next few days. Can I have at least three fundamental disagreements with
you? Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I am here because James suggested that I might like to come on this journey with him. So he asked permission, and it was granted. And that is the short reason of why I am here. The big reason of why I'm here as an individual, experiencing my individual quest and relating to each one of you as you're experiencing. That will unfold, I imagine, as this week unfolds. Today on the airplane, I sat with three people in an airplane, James, myself, and this woman. And this woman and I began to speak, and it turned out she was supposed to have taken that flight 2 weeks ago, but there was an ice storm in the East Coast, so her flight was canceled. So then when she got to the plane today, she was supposed to have sat in a different row, and something happened. So she found herself sitting next to me. And this woman who, you know, why were we sitting next to each other at this particular time, spoke the entire, or much of a trip from Philadelphia, not the entire trip, but maybe half of the trip, on and off, from Philadelphia to San Francisco. And we had enormous amount of things in common. So we were individuals on a journey who crossed paths, who inspired each other, who gave each other something. And I think that's sort of how I live my life most every day. And I think that's why I'm here. I have a long story. I could tell you that 26 years ago, I left New Orleans as a student and landed at Esalen Institute and lived there for several years. And that began a very deep study in human consciousness that hasn't ceased. So, I look forward to, I don't know how many of these sessions I will be in this week because I have some of my own personal agenda, which is doing some artwork and having a very peaceful place and some personal time. But that's my story.
Well, thank you, everybody. 9:30.
I think. Well, you're really tight these days.
Well, we like to run a tight ship here. Keep everything really organized.
If Jane could have spoken another 6 minutes, we could have proven Steve's theory. I think.
Well, I think we could really win in terms of keeping within a fairly good compass.
We did better this year than we did last year.
Yeah, well, last year I was sore because I was one of the first to speak, but I think I was the first.
So, well, I think we probably should quit, partly because Claire and Steve are both pretty good. Russ and three of you guys are.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry.
We haven't decided when anyone's going to speak.
Oh, yeah, good point. I think we at least need to have some clarity about who's going to be going tomorrow, right? The first three sessions. One option would be for me to pass around the sign-up sheet and have everybody sign up. But I think I'd rather just leave it if we could say who would like to go tomorrow. Okay, Claire, you definitely want to go tomorrow. Okay. Nick? We have a third person?
Well, I'm happy to do something tomorrow morning, but I do think, actually, although you've got three individual presentations, quickly read one of Claire's papers, and I know Nick's work for years, much of which he knows I disagree with, there's no email meeting. And I imagine we'll have more than enough to talk about in that one morning with two, do you not think?
Well, will we be able to get in everybody's session if we start expanding and if we can take a couple of questions?
Well, it depends. If we go with this model that is beginning to emerge, where we basically say that we expect that the time we have will be, a lot of it will be devoted to group discussion, and if we therefore say we don't need to set aside separate time for group discussion, then a little bit more time becomes available. Am I making this up clear? I'm not
sure.
That gives us at least another 3 hours or so. And I think we could maybe just try with a couple of people tomorrow and see how it goes. So we can do a couple of people and then take a break and maybe talk at the break about
what's
going to happen. Full lunch,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, rather than 3 to 2.
So what's happening?
So it'll be Claire and Nick who make presentations tomorrow.
What about the afternoon this week? There's another one, yeah.
Then in the afternoon
need two more than in the afternoon.
Yeah, then we would probably do two more in the afternoon rather than doing this general session which was devoted to a particular topic. So basically, from 3 until 6, we would do 2 more.
So you still need 2 volunteers.
So, well, are there 2 people who would like to definitely, commit to that time from tomorrow afternoon? With the idea that it's kind of open what you do with it. You're the...
I'll
you control that time. Okay.
Steve?
I prefer to leave tomorrow to other people.
Okay.
So Walt and I'll go in the afternoon.
Okay.
As long as everybody knows that I don't know what I'm talking about.
It's okay. You will be in good company.
And I think what I'm going to do, I'm actually going to give my talk about the loneliness of consciousness.
Loneliness.
Morning, start. Okay, well, since I'm probably the most jet lagged of anybody and most awake tomorrow morning, so maybe I should start.
I think
What did Helen have that was taken away from her?
She must
have
had,
yeah, oh, sorry, I know that it was an ablation, I know that. But she must have had, for you to notice the difference, there must have been something she had before she ended with only a thing. She had no access.
She didn't know she could see.
Right. But she must have had some phenomenal consciousness for it to be removed in a way, with the removal of that part of the visual.
We started right now.
Right.
I just can't help it. I'm sorry. It's one of those things that bothers me about Helen.
There's so much time if we start tonight.
Well, I think the rest is, I mean, I've worried that, I mean, at times I want to do my phenomenal consciousness to anyone, any other. And yet, my story about Helen is that she lacked phenomenal consciousness.
Yeah, but she must have had it to have it.
Yes, I mean, I'm not convinced I was right about her, but I certainly, when it was extended to human beings, that turned out to be the right story to tell about them.
But she was then, you then said you taught her to see again. I wonder how much of that was to do with her being able to smell the raisins on the floor.
Well, how would you guys relate that to the old concept of epiphenomenalism? I mean, there's just that the perception was there, but the thing that comes along later wasn't, you know.
Well, in the human cases of insight, it's very clear.
Yeah, but I would never have thought of it.
They have the information, but they don't know how to get it.
Yeah.
If nothing they can tell about.
Okay, but might that not apply in this?
It doesn't seem to be anything to do with them. They don't feel connected to it, they don't feel involved in it. And they don't enjoy it. That's one of the most interesting things.
But the interesting thing I think about the human cases is that in human cases they have no will to post the letter. You know, the idea is that you can post the letter and you've got to be urged to post the letter.
No,
because you don't see the...
That's not blanket. That's a
hemispheric blanket. Oh, that's the hemispheric neglect.
Okay, but
with blindsight, if you don't know something is there, you have to be pushed to make a judgment about it.
They won't guess about it because they don't know they can do it.
Right, so they've got to be made to guess. Then why would Helen go around and pick up the raisins? Nothing's making her do this. Could it simply be
I think monkeys are not so embarrassed as human beings. I mean, human patients think the situation is absurd. Mm-hmm. They say, look, doctor, you know I can't see you, there's nothing there, it doesn't feel like anything. You know, what are you trying to get me to do? Are you trying to make a problem?
Mm-hmm.
And several of the patients have refused to take part in these studies because of that. In a monkey's case, they're not going to be embarrassed. If they find they can do it, I can think, well, I want them to be able to do this. And somebody's trying to make a fool of me.
Mm.
So I think that's part of the story. Mm. That the pure perception emerges as a capacity without puzzling them in any way, as it were to a human being, and without them rejecting it as a possible way of seeing, which is a real problem for human beings.
So they have kind of access consciousness without a phenomenon?
Yeah.
Let's break for tonight.
Okay,
so you're going tomorrow. We have so breakfast at 7 starts at 7:45 tomorrow. And it's a buffet breakfast, just come in any time, but remember that we start at 8:45.
In the same place?
Yes.
Up the stairs.
Yes, up the stairs.
And does everyone know how to get back to the
house? Yes, it's still there.
Because it's going to be, like, dark out there. Has everyone got their torches?
No.
Right.
So
we can
if we're all in the same
compound, I have one, maybe that's why I'm here. Thank you.
The thing I thought
that taped pretty well, didn't it?
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's just kind of on mic.
Yeah, it's actually here. I'll play a little back for you. I'll play a little back for you.